Sarah Robinson, the moderator. We have Mr. Stephen Plato from organization.
Chutz La'aretz.
Just landed this morning.
You're never.
Thanks, Shkoyach. Jet lag is slowly catching on. And Stephen is from the Stand Up for Israel organization. I'll speak about
No, not Stand Up for Israel. I'm just myself.
Okay. representing himself. Rabbi Yishai Fleischer, who is the spokesman of the Jewish community of Hebron, also a journalist and a broadcast person in Israel, and wrote the one pillar to the world CEO of Mizrahi. Bakasha.
Thank you so much for joining this panel. And I'd like to open with the following question. What does it mean to be a Zionist in Chutz La'aretz? Is it a contradiction? And if it is a contradiction, are there solutions?
Are we standing at the podium or are we sitting in our place? How would you like it? Huh?
Shalom, everybody. It's nice to see you. You know, I bumped into some of you even on the plane as you were coming over here. And I want to, first thing, before we ever start a talk like this, there's a little bit of politics, but here it's not politics. Here I really want to thank some of the people that are around in this building. Rabbi Hillel, who invited me to this program, thank you. Mori Verabi, Rabbi Blau, who I grew up with intellectually at Yeshiva University. Rabbi Daron Peretz, whose name goes before him. Stephen Flato, whose daughters were my classmates, including Alyssa. And I also heard that there's people amongst you, including a young lady named Sarah Robinson, that's right, and Jacob Bernstein, who made this happen for you. So I think that that's an incredible thing. So a round of applause for all these amazing people. And the biggest round of applause should really go to you, because you're here right now in Eretz Yisrael instead of being on spring break getting plastered in Jamaica. You're here in Eretz Yisrael. I think I had a funny phrase about that. Instead of getting wasted, you're utilizing yourself. I think that this kind of program is actually exactly what we're talking about in this panel. How do we connect Zionism and diaspora existence, right? Who here lives in the diaspora? Yes, where are you guys from? Lawrence's? And anybody outside of the New York area? Where are you from, bro?
Ottawa.
Right, been there, yeah. Chicago, great. What else? Yeah. Boca Raton, Boca. I was just in Boca. I just came back from Boca. Barely, you know what I mean? The gullus, it pulls you back in. You know, just when I thought I was out. Yeah?
Philadelphia.
Philly, good. Anybody from different countries or anything like that? And you guys all go to school, what, in New York and various areas? Anybody else outside of New York? Okay, so wonderful. So the very fact that you're here right now means that somebody's been thinking about the very topic of this panel, which is how do we bridge this gap? My phrase always is that we have to hold hands across the Atlantic. Because, look, at 18 you could be walking into a Target, and at 18 your Israeli counterpart could be walking into a place where he is a Target, right? Get it? He's becoming an IDF soldier, and you're, you know, in a different existence. Amazing sales just now at Macy's, by the way. I was just there. It was unbelievable. I barely tore myself away. What I mean to say by that is not in any way to compare some kind of negative comparison. No, I'm saying we have different life trajectories. As Jews, we're living a very different life. By the way, on birthright, what is the number one experience that young people are most moved by according to their own feedback papers? What? I cannot hear you. Say something.
The barbecue.
Har Herzl is a top one. That's a top one. Good. Very good. What else? That's right. It's the Western world's big, Masada's big, but the number one thing is meeting soldiers. I mean, what's the big deal? It's just another dude or dudette. What's the deal? It's because I'm meeting somebody who's my counterpart, but he or she's living a totally different life, and we're bridging this gap across the Atlantic, and easily we could be so distant from one another, easily we could not know about each other's lives. That's the great challenge, and that's what this panel is dealing with. So I want to tell you a quick story. I just spoke in Brooklyn at Rabbi Mansour's shul, Eli Mansour. Do you know who that is? You know. He's amazing. Anybody who's slightly given to any Sephardi way of being knows who Eli Mansour is. So Ashkenazi, but some of them, I knew who he was. He's a very important guy. He's a person who teaches a lot of Torah, and he's got his very specific style, and he's a real tough guy, and he's, you know, building a shul now for $35 million, and he's a, you know, a real teacher of Torah throughout the internet and the world. And he doesn't give up the podium very easily Friday night, but he gave it to me, little old me. Why? So he gets up there before I speak, and he says, "Rabotai, I want to tell you." And he goes on to tell a story that he goes every year to Eretz Yisrael, and he goes to the four holy cities. And the four holy cities, according to his explanation, is that just like the four letters names of Hashem, the Tetragrammaton, it combines in different ways, you got to go to these cities. He starts explaining all this stuff. He says, "I go to all the places in Eretz Yisrael, Kol Kadosh," right? And he says, "But this time I didn't come to Hebron." Why? Because he says, "My Yetzer, my inclination told me it's dangerous right now. Maybe skip it this time." And he didn't go to Ma'arat HaMachpelah. That's how he says it. He didn't go there. And he says he gets on the plane and he felt guilty inside that he skipped out something. And it bothered him on the whole flight. He couldn't sleep. It just bothered him that he didn't go to Kivrei Avot V'Imahot. He skipped the forefathers and mothers. And he gets off the plane. He turns on his fancy phone. And he sees an email from one of his congregants. A person from Hebron wants to come to your synagogue and speak. Will you let him? So he thought to himself, "I skipped out on Hebron, but Hebron came to me." He says, "That's why I want to introduce to you Yishai Fleischer." And what I thought was very instructive about that story is that sometimes you can't come to Israel for various reasons, but Israel comes to you. And I want to say right off the bat that this building and the Zionism that has come out of this building really has an apex. What is the apex of the Zionism that this kind of place teaches? What is it? What is the best Zionist thing you could do? Come on. Spit it out. What is it?
Make Aliyah.
That's right, make Aliyah is the apex. Make Aliyah! And as Rabbi Blau knows, I drove the school crazy about issues related to Aliyah when I was at Yeshiva University. But I want to come out right from an axiom at the beginning of this conversation, which is Aliyah is certainly the apex. And it's really the starting point of a new life here in Israel. But you know what, though? If that was the end of the conversation, then 6 million Jews would be outside of that conversation, or a good chunk of them in any case. And we wouldn't really need to have this conversation because I could just say the word Aliyah and keep going. And you know what? There's a lot to talk about Aliyah. But I believe that there are many, many small aliyot, many, many things that you could do in your life that make a tremendous difference to do what? To bind us together as a people and to keep the diaspora connected with the story of Israel and keep the story of Israel connected with the diaspora, which is, by the way, no less of a problem because they don't know what you're doing out there. And they don't know your life. We don't know your life. And it's easy to drift apart like two tectonic plates separating from one another. We have to stop that from happening. So, I know the tension between America and Israel. I promise you something about America. I'm a big Zionist. I've been pushing Aliyah for many years. But if you think that I'm one of those kind of guys who's like, "Ew, New York, oh, America, materialism, I hate it," that's not me. I love New York. I call it my Eshet Potifar. She's always calling me back, bringing me in. But instead of leaving my clothes with her, I take clothes from her, from Banana Republic, and I bring them here. That's like my little revenge on Eshet Potifar. But the truth is that, and I say this with no joking manner whatsoever, I promise you with all seriousness, you have to believe me, New York has a tremendous pull on me. The minute I'm across the bridge in New Jersey, I could not care less. But when I'm in Manhattan, I'm just like, wow, this place is just dominating. And also, my most pleasurable intellectual part of my life was at Yeshiva University, and so forth. There's many things about that great city which are very attractive. I know the tension. Many of you don't even feel this way, but some do. I know the tension between America, or maybe Boca, that great gravitational pull of Boca. I know about it, and it's real. There's a multiculturalism there. I love the subways. There's a freedom there. There's in some ways more freedom there than there are here, than there is here. And there is, just sitting on a subway train with a Chinese person and a black person and a chassid and who knows what. There's something amazing about that whole thing. Still, though, we have a Torah and we have a call. And we have, as Rabbi Ramon was trying to really, drum up here, we're having also an incredible period the rebirth of the Jewish people in the land of Israel, which is a miraculous period. So how do we bridge these two things? I can't say it's easy. For me, when I land in New York, it takes me 3 days to figure out how to deal emotionally and otherwise. Maybe for Rabbi Peretz in South Africa, I don't know. I heard that Joburg is Cape Town is one of the most beautiful cities in the world. Certainly, the Jews who make Aliyah from Australia, I'm always like, I salute you because you broke out of that great country. So how do we bridge these things? Well, certainly through Judaism. And the key to Judaism has always been, what's the word I'm looking for? Education. How many of you have been through Zionist education of different kinds through your schoolings? One person? Yes, yes. Okay, I was just in the Syrian community in Brooklyn, and I went to an Aliyah meeting there. I couldn't believe it. I said to them, what is going on that there's even an Aliyah meeting? Just to give you a clue, these people are very wealthy and super packed in family-wise. They like cannot move. They're not allowed to move 15 minutes away from their parents. That's just like the rule. I'm talking about walking on Shabbat, okay? So how come there's an Aliyah meeting? Well, there's two reasons. One was economic. It's just too costly to make to live in Brooklyn unless you're making literally $400,000 to stay afloat with teaching your children Jewish education, all that. So some people are thinking about Aliyah because of economics. But what's the other reason? Yeshiva Flatbush. It teaches Zionism. You teach Zionism, it works. My school, my high school, I went to Frisch, but before that I went to Kushner. Anybody ever heard of Kushner? So they're teaching Zionism. I was one of the first Chayalim Bodidim that came out of Kushner. Guess what? Last year they had like 30. So Zionist education works. We got to keep teaching it. What's the greatest Zionist education tool that ever existed? Certainly for the conservative reform crowd? Birthright. I was just flying to Israel, and there was people next to me from Ithaca College flying to Israel during this knife intifada. And they're like, yay, can't wait to see Tel Aviv. And I'm just like, this is amazing. People are scared to fly to Israel. These Birthright kids are like, I can't believe it, free trip to Israel. It's going to change their life. Zionist education works. I'm going to go fast. I don't want to take up time from other speakers. I have a few ideas which will connect us and help us bridge across the Atlantic. One small thing which I highly recommend, which my wife and I did at Yeshiva University, was buy Israeli products. Eat Israeli products. Why? To support the Israeli economy? Sure, that's great, but we're doing all right. That's not the real issue. When you drink from the wine of Eretz Yisrael, you know those Bart Nura wines? They're really good, right? Don't drink them. Skip it. I'm sorry. Boycott an Italian wine. What I mean is, drink Israeli wine. It makes your very cellular, on a cellular level, you become part of Israel. Drink the water that Eliyahu Navi drank. Be part of it. I know Hasidim in Brooklyn that buy a drink like this, like one of those, what are they called? Spring and other drinks from Israel. What are they called? Pre-got. No, they have the other ones a little bit more. Anyway, whatever, soft drinks. And they go like this Hasidim. They open it up. And they go. They take a sniff. Why? Because Avira, the Eretz Israel Machkima, the air of the land of Israel, makes you smart. So they take a whiff as they open the bottle from Eretz Israel. I love it though. It connects them to the land of Israel. So one simple thing is like make it into a thing. We would serve it as dessert, water from the land of Israel, make people drink it out of shot glasses. Like make it holy, make it special, turn people on. Make regalim a part of your life. You know, the Torah has, for this panel, the Torah has an answer. If you're living in the diaspora, how do you connect to Israel? Regalim. What is regalim? Come 3 times a year to Israel, right? So I'm working on a law right now in Knesset to try to drop the prices down. How did you get here to Israel now? They helped you with the price, right? Were you guys going to buy a $1,000 ticket? Seriously. Well, let's be real, right? But they subsidized it. Rabbi Blau and our good friend Marty Olin are good people, right? So that's what got you here. Imagine if the government would drop all the airport taxes and the fuel taxes so that the price point could be $500 for a gun. That would make a difference.
And the VAT.
And the VAT. Help people out. For God's sakes, do you know who took the idea of regalim from us? Have you ever heard of a little thing called the Hajj? That's a good, what is that? A million people come to a three-day, week-long journey to Saudi Arabia. They put on some togas, and they're like, wow, this is amazing. They get free food, free beds, and they're walking around, they're getting excited, and at the end they're like, Islam rocks! Because they just had an awesome seven-day Hajj trip. That word Hajj comes from the Hebrew word chag. It's the same word. It means going around, like machogim, go around. Like they go around the Kaaba stone. We're supposed to go walk around Yerushalayim. Okay? So, how about we come to Israel 3 times a year? But if you can't make it 3 times a year, how about once a year, even in the summertime, make your own personal regular. Do not go to Jamaica. Do not go to St. Martin. All right? People do it all the time. I see even in Israel, they're like, Pesach in St. Martin. Great. How about Pesach in Yerushalayim? So there's ways to connect. What, is there booze in that? You guys love St. Martin? I don't want to hold up any more time. I'll finish up maybe with one more idea. Imagine if the state of Israel would say, the Jews in the diaspora are very important, including the rabbinate would recognize that inside joke. Imagine if the state of Israel... Did you hear about this? I don't want to talk about it. How many Knesset members are there? Quick. 120, thank you. Imagine if there was a 121st Knesset member who was elected by the diaspora Jews. And this 121st Knesset member would be the minister of the diaspora, minister of diaspora affairs. And he would actually fly around. Maybe it would be like at their own parents, right? And he would get to become the minister of diaspora affairs and fly around the world and connect Jews to the story of Israel. They chose him. How do you have an election of all the Jews in the world? How do you do that? Simple. It's called Facebook, okay? Let's call Mark Zuckerberg. Mark, come on, you're one of the tribe. I know, come on. Right? And help us make some kind of election and elect a person to be our representative in the Knesset. Tell the world, Israel's not just for Israelis. Israel's for Jews. My friends, it's a way of thinking. It's a way of thinking about how do we bridge this giant ocean and giant cultural divide. It's education. It's things like you coming here. It's like this very event. And all we have to do is we have to ignite and invigorate the passion that's already there. There's no greater story in the earth, and you're part of it. I know sometimes a lot of speeches make you sleepy, but believe me, you're part of the most exciting story that the world has ever seen. And I want to wish everybody success and keep thinking about that, bridging that gap.
Mr. Plato, can you share with us what does it mean to be a Zionist in Chutz La'aretz?
Now you know why I love Yishai Fleischer. Although I thought amphetamines were outlawed in Israel also. I've only known him since he was either 8 or 9 years old, and he hasn't changed. But he represents the best of what we see when someone from Chutz La'aretz comes to Eretz Yisrael. His heart is in it 110%. So thank you. I remember starting Hebrew school, an after-school Hebrew program in Middle Village, Queens. I was about 7 years old. We're sitting in the classroom, and on the wall was a cartoon. And there was an Israeli in the middle of a circle of Arabs, and it said, "Welcome to the neighborhood." And behind each Arab's back was a knife. And here we are some 60 years later, and behind each Arab nation's back is a knife poised at the state of Israel in the center. I guess the more things change, the more they stay the same. This trip is my third in 3 months. My wife and I decided to come with our granddaughter, Michal, who was 13 and a half. Did you ever notice that when you're my age, 67, you don't say you're 67 and a half, but you say that your child is 4 and a half or 23 months or 13 and a half. And we were trying to count in the car on the way to the hotel. And I'm very happy to say that this is Michal's either her sixth or her seventh trip to Israel. And she said something to me last year as we were going back to Newark Airport. We were sitting in the lounge in Tel Aviv, and she had this look on her face. I said, "What are you thinking of?" She said, you know, Grandpa, I realized something. When Israelis are yelling at each other at the table, they're not really yelling at each other. They're just talking to each other. And they're just excited to talk about the country and to talk about politics and to talk about religion. And they want to be sure that the other person hears them. And then the other thing I learned, actually I learned from my son who now lives in Jerusalem for the last several years, is I always thought when someone does this to you, it was a curse. And all it really means is just, wait a second. And these are the kinds of experiences that when I go back to the States, as I will next Tuesday, make me very proud to be an American Zionist. Because there is so much to be done in America. We have a scholarship fund called the Elisa Flater Memorial Scholarship Fund. It was established in 1995 after our then 20-year-old daughter Elisa was murdered here in a terror attack. She was doing what you were doing. You were here. She was actually here to study for 6 months at Nishmat here in Jerusalem. And she went on vacation before Pesach, and the bus she was riding in was bombed near the settlement of Kfar Darom in the Gaza Strip. She was one of seven who were murdered in that attack. And we thought, how do you best memorialize a college student? Elise was here on her sixth trip, actually. How do we memorialize a college student who believed that Israel was her home? Not New Jersey, but Israel was her home. And we figured out that the best way to do that was to be able to assist students your age to come and study in Israel, primarily on the gap year program. But the scholarship is open for young men and women from the diaspora who seek to study Judaism in Israel post high school. So we've had most of our applications are from students doing the gap year. But I've had applications from men and women in their 20s and 30s. I'll never forget, one of them opened up. She was a young woman from Sweden who says, I just discovered my Jewish roots a year ago. And I've been accepted to study at the Reform Seminary here in Jerusalem. And it would mean so much to me to be able to do that. So our application process is actually very tough. Every application gets reviewed at least two, and sometimes three times. And what we're looking for is for that student who is a successful applicant to be growing in their Judaism, to be growing in their Yiddishkeit, to be growing in who they are. It doesn't disqualify you if you've been here before, but the fact of the matter is that most of our applicants are growing in their Jewish studies. And we gave this young woman scholarship, and I'm very pleased to tell you that today she is a chaplain in a synagogue in Amsterdam. And I will tell you, it's the Reform Gay Lesbian Transgender ? Synagogue. But you know something? She's teaching. She's teaching about Israel. She's teaching about the Jewish people. And though some of the practices that they may follow differ from what I call mainstream Judaism or my version of Judaism, you know what? She's educating people. And out of that group, someone's going to come to Israel and they're going to say, you know what? This is my home. I like it here. And they're going to stay. But more importantly, what I have found is that every student that we send to Israel, as you are sitting here today, when you go home, not only are you going to be a better Jew, you're going to be a better person. Because there's something here in the air, whether it's the sniff of the water or the bottle of wine that we can take back in the States, it's something here that will change you in a small way. It's going to alter who you are. Now, my role as a parent in the diaspora is a very simple one. I educate my children to be Zionists. And sure enough, as Yishai referred to, my son, who was a graduate of Kushner, became a lone soldier here about 9 or 10 years ago. He was on kibbutz first. He learned how to milk cows. He learned how to farm fish. which is what they do with Staley Yahoo. He learned that that there are enterprises here in Israel that are actually technically mind-numbing. There's a firm at Staley Yahoo called BioBee. And what they do is they study ways to genetically alter insects that are beneficial to beehives. And they ship these buggers around the world, especially when they are under attack by parasites and other insects that do beehives harm. And then he decided that he wanted to volunteer for the IDF. Well, unfortunately, they wouldn't, even though he passed his psychological exams, they wouldn't accept him, because they apparently have a rule that when you lose a sibling in a terror attack, we don't exactly want to put you in the front lines. He said, but if you become a citizen, then we'll have to draft you. So he becomes a citizen, and 6 months later, they draft him. He's 25 years of age, and he goes to his training camp, and they say, what would you like to do? He says, I want to be a combat soldier. He wants to follow in Yishai Fleischer's footsteps. And they go, you know, a couple of things. First of all, you're 25 years old. You're too old to learn anything. And second of all, we're not sure your parents would want you to be in a combat role. So you know what? We're going to make you what you would call in America a jobnik. We're going to teach you a trade. And they sent him to a furniture factory. And he learned how to make furniture that the IDF was using. And they even offered him a job when he was done. But, you know, it made him a different person. Because when I went to visit him during his tekkus, his graduation is the right word, I guess, his graduation from basic training, there he was talking to with a boy from England, a boy from South Africa, a boy from Ethiopia, and a boy from Russia, and they were speaking in Hebrew. And I thought we're looking at a prophecy that's come true. You know, Zechariah has a prophecy, and he says there'll come a time, God tells him there'll come a time when the old men and women will be standing or leaning on their canes, and their children will be playing in the streets. Eitan wasn't playing, his friends weren't playing. But now when I walk on the streets and I see the prophecy come true that we're back, that's the message that I, as a diaspora Jew, try to get out in the United States. And I think back to the pushka, the blue and white pushka can that was on my grandmother's shelf and on my mother's shelf, that every Erev Shabbos, before they lit Shabbos candles, they put in 10 cents, quarter, a nickel, whatever it was. And that's been ongoing since time immemorial, the pushka for Israel. And I mourn the loss of that pushka today, because there are so many of people of my generation who have forgotten that link. So it's my job to write about Israel, to stand up for Israel in the media. And you can Google my name, it's F-L-A-T-O-W, and you can see about the subjects I'm writing about. And that's one of the jobs that a diaspora Jew can take on for themselves, and that is to stand up for the state of Israel, to stand up for Medinat Yisrael in different forms and different forums. So you give financial support, you give political support, you give technical support, but more importantly, you encourage people to follow in the footsteps of those who know better, those who have actually made the plunge. People ask me all the time, you know, you're such a big Zionist, why aren't you in Jerusalem? And I always hesitate, I always pause, and I do admit that I should be here. But, you know, Parnassa, I'm still making a living in the United States of America, one that I couldn't transplant here. So that's my personal escape clause, my personal escape hatch. But I want to join with what Yishai said a little while ago. I'm so proud to be here looking at you, getting ready to take your questions in a few minutes, and exploring with you what you can do as an American or simply as a diaspora Jew for Israel. So thank you for having me on this panel. Thank you, Sarah, for doing what you're doing, for what Mizrahi is doing, what the RZA has done. and I wish I could applaud you, so thank you.
And Rabbi Blau, please share with us what it means to be a Zionist in Chutz Laaretz.
The first thing is that you need to justify why you're not in Israel. Doesn't mean it can't be justified in particular situations. We even, believe it or not, I guess I'm too young to appreciate this. The late Nechama Leibovitz, another bracha, would be always, when she taught, she would press people about being in Israel. And I was once at one of her settings, and my wife and I knew her, and she actually gave us a free pass. She said, if you're staying in Chutz Laaretz, you have to be in Chinuch like the Blau. Right? You have to be teaching the Jews, because that's needed all over the world. But it means that you have to really think about it. What I really want to focus on, because it's really something that troubles me a great deal, is the unity of the Jewish people. And we'll start with the unity of the religious Jewish people, which after all are united in a commitment to Torah and Mitzvot. And when I was a kid, the day school that I went to, I mean, there weren't so many in the whole country, taught in Hebrew. So when I come to Israel, when I'm asked to speak somewhere, and I speak in Hebrew, and they asked me, where did you learn Hebrew? I said, I learned in elementary school. How many day schools in America now teach in Hebrew? Huh? Very, very few. Very few. How many, the gap year, the year you spent learning in Israel, the 2 years some of you spent learning in Israel, did you spend it in a program where everybody else spoke English, where the shiurim were in English, where everything was done to accommodate. The notion of being international was with some Brits and some South Africans and some Australians. Did you integrate with Israelis at all? Even in the schools where they're joint Israelis and Americans, they don't interact very much. And that's very sad. It's taking a situation. And the Torah there to Israel is wonderful, but a whole dimension that could be isn't. And you know why? Because, frankly, most people don't care enough to deal with the more complex situation where they have to function in Hebrew. Now, there's a reason why there's so many schools for Americans in Israel in English, because they're much easier, because you have to struggle. Our youngest son, because we live in Washington Heights, the yeshiva, and the only day school in Washington Heights is Breuer's. And as you could well imagine, for those who are in yeshiva, they're not very big on Ivrit, or Ivris either, right? Maybe if you taught in German, we'd have a chance, but they're not. And our youngest son came straight from Breuer's through high school to learn in the Gush, at a time where there was no shiur in English. How did he adjust? He adjusted because he wanted to adjust. He worked at it. Shiur, he said, not so difficult. After all, it's Gemara Lashon. The Sicha Friday night, disaster. Right? It was disaster till no longer was disaster because he got to know it and understand it. Because you have to want to gain that language. We have to increase interaction. It's critical for American Jewry, but it's also critical for Israeli Jewry to have a sense of responsibility for the Jewish people. You know, when you have your own country, you can become narrowly functioning. We have my nation and my country. Right? But our national identity is not separate from, but it's integrated with our religious identity. When we talk about, we can talk also how to deal with those Jews who don't yet have the same commitment to Torah, but let's start with those who do. Let's try to find ways of interacting much more than we do now. There's a challenge. There's a great challenge that your generation faces that my generation didn't. And I don't even think my children's generation didn't, but my grandchildren's generation certainly does. And that is the gap in mentality, in identification between American young Jews and Israeli young Jews is much greater than it used to be. And that's a tremendous danger to all that we stand for. Tremendous danger. You know, we're not discussing politics. There's no question that America's commitment to Israel in the long haul will be much less if the Jews don't care. If you don't care for your own people, why should we ask other people to do it for us? The Talmud will get the evangelic. No, no. We have to get our own people first. One. And number two, that it goes both ways, but the other way that you can't do much about. Young Israeli Jews have to know they're part of the Jewish people. They're not Israelis who happen to be Jewish. The Jewishness is integral part of being there. Israeli means they can, right? When their gap year after army doesn't have to be to India, maybe to be someplace a little bit more Jewish, right? We're not going to change the whole world, but we can start with ourselves. We can start with a commitment. And then, I'll be frank, I do a test. Every time there's an Israeli election, I go around YU and Stern and ask people about the election. To discover, I ask them...
So for you.
So I ask them, do you know which parties are running in the election? And they look at me, they don't know. Did you wake up the day after the election to find out what happened? Right? Was it as important as finding out who won the sporting event of the team that you cared about? This the identification process is not what it should be. And I'm talking to people in this room who learned in Israel and just came back to Israel. You check every morning to see what happened in Israel. Right? You can get it. You don't have to buy a newspaper. Right? It's on your phone. It's on your phone. It's on your phone in endless different ways, and we can tell you other ways if you could actually read some Hebrew. But luckily, most of the papers have English translations. You don't even have to do that. No. Care. Make it part of your life. Make a decision. You may end up... Look, we know the Aliyah rate from the United States is very low. And all that have been wonderful stories, but it's, in terms of real numbers, it's not there. And it's harder for it to make Aliyah than for the States. Because, you know, if you're living in France, and it's very hard to be a Jew in France, and you're afraid for your life, it's much easier to make Aliyah. If you're living in the five towns, and it's not bad, right? And you have a comfortable life, and you have a full Jewish life, you have kosher restaurants wherever you turn.
Kol
Yisrael. You have yeshiva, what's it called? It's where everybody seems to be moving. You live in Teaneck, all right? You live in Teaneck, and you have a choice of four or five yeshiva elementary schools. At least four, I know, of high school without moving out of Teaneck, right? Without even going any further, you have a real Jewish life. And most people are going to stick with that Jewish life. Okay? But at least show you care. Come. Be a little irregular. I love Yishai's idea. You should tell the people who run the airlines. Because they figured out, you know, that
Milka,
you know, the price going into Israel before Pesach is much higher than it was now, right? It's the opposite because that's where the market is, right? It's the market that you're gonna charge. You charge a lot of money. People aren't gonna, you get some and not enough. But bottom line is Israel is has to be part of our Jewish identity. And we have to try to figure out ways to communicate with others. I turn to those people in the room who are not yeshiva from Stern. And, you know, you have a real responsibility on your campus. But the responsibility only works if you're educated. Because if you're going to come to lose a debate, you're not helping Israel very much. And you'll lose a debate if you don't know what you're talking about. If you don't know what their complaints are. If you don't know the issues, you can wave a flag, but then the first time someone asks you a question, you never heard of anything, you're not going to be particularly helpful. You've got to be educated about it. There's much we can do for Israel. There's much that has to be done to grow, to make an integral part of our Jewish life. And this is not the place, but we have to find a way in Israel as well. Rav Daron, the shlichim he sends. And, it's, you know, by the way, it also involves training. Over the years, I've been a chinuch for a very long time. I've been a chinuch about as long as Rabbi Riskin has been in Rabbanut, which should be surprising since we were in school together for so many years. I was then a year older. I'm trying not to stay older, but I think it can't change. A year ahead of him. Many Israeli shlichim who taught in the yeshiva were a disaster. They were a disaster because they didn't understand the community they were coming to. Paris knows what it is in South Africa. If a shliach comes and doesn't understand where he's coming to, doesn't understand the language, doesn't understand the culture, he's not going to have any real impact. So it's a job to be done in broader ways. But for you, I say, tomorrow morning, you go back to Shiva Seminary, or tonight, if you find some Israelis there, if there are any, talk to them in Hebrew. And if you can't find anybody in school to talk to, my middle son, who lives here, was a Rosh Yeshiva here in the American institution, of course, when he came to Israel the first year, he actually went to a Haredi yeshiva, which was in English. And at the end of the year, he spoke Hebrew. And I said, you didn't hear a word of Hebrew in the yeshiva the whole year. He said, yes, but I had to buy food in the makolet. I went on a bus. I made it my business to speak Hebrew and listen to Hebrew. If you really if you care, even in an American institution, you can learn some Hebrew too.
Finally, Rav Perez, please share with us how you think Zionism can work in Chutz Laaretz.
I'm really going to be brief, because I'm losing my voice. And secondly, and most importantly, really, some wonderful things have been said, which I wholeheartedly agree with by the three speakers before. So I just want to make two ideas, one about Israel to diaspora and one about diaspora Jewry to Israel. The first thing I want to say, just picking up from what Rabbi Blau said, is I believe wholeheartedly in the position of where I am in Israel at the moment is our responsibility is towards diaspora Jewry. It's very much being spoken about in Israel today, as Yishai mentioned and then Rabbi Blau and others, that there's a real shift in consciousness in Israel, and halavai your law will get passed. That'll be unbelievable, because I think the regalim is exactly the place to do it. But our responsibility needs to be, what can we do for diaspora Jewry? How can we educate better? How can we make Israel more accessible? How can we send the best possible shlichim? And that's really what we are committed to over here. And I believe, Higi Azman of Ki Mitzion Tetzei Torah, that we have to, 70 years ago when the state of Israel was established, there was no state, there was barely a society, 600,000 people. What has shifted in the last 70 years is the central point of Jewish destiny and Jewish life is now in Israel. The center is in Israel. The Merkaz in Israel, there's a state with incredible institutions contributing not only to Israeli society, but to world Jewry and to the human experience in the most unbelievable way. The Torah has been rebuilt in the most incredible ways. I think in so many ways, there isn't enough time to speak of, you know, the rebirth of Torah since the terrible Shoah, the rebirth of Torah Shebichtav, how Tanakh has become totally revived. More has been written in Tanakh in the last 50 years, in the last 2,000 years. This is unbelievable how Tanakh has come alive in the Eretz, the land of the Tanakh, Eretz Yisrael, has brought alive Torah as well. So I think our responsibility from Israel is towards the Aspera Jewry. What difference can we make and bring Torah and Eretz Yisrael in the deepest possible way? The final point I want to make, one point, because so many beautiful things have been said, and the hour is late. I just want to say one idea, a contextual idea, what I believe the paradigm, the framework for the diaspora Jewry should be in terms of Zionism to Israel. I saw this in the Kli Yakar. I subsequently found the same idea in the Maharsha on Masechet Megillah. I want to share it with you. It's a brief idea. And I was so excited when I learned this piece of Torah, because for me it contextualizes what I believe. Everything that's been spoken about being a Zionist in Chutz La'aretz is contextualized by this particular Gemara and the Kli Yakar and Rabbi and the Maharsha's comment. There's a Gemara Masechet Brachot which says Adav Chet, Rabbi Yochanan says, he questions Rabbi Yochanan, Ikas Sabe Bavel. Can it be that there are elderly people in Babel? How do people reach long life? There's a pasuk that we all know from the end of the second parak of the Shema, Leman Yarechun Yamecha. We all know the pasuk. Ala Adama Asher Nishba Lavotecha. You only have long life, Leman Yarechun Yamecha, Ala Adama, in the land of Israel. So, okay, there's a galut. How can it be that if there's an explicit pasuk that Arichut Yamim is only in Israel, how can it be that people are living till all years in Chutz La'aretz? So, the Gemara answers, since people go to shul early and spend time in shul, people are learning, people are davening, they live a long and good life. The Kli Yakar on this pasuk Leman Yarechun Yamecha in Dvarim asks the following question. Listen to this. He says, I don't understand, you didn't ask the question. The question was, how do people live so long in Chutz La'aretz? It's a pasuk which says you only have long life in Israel. And what did you answer? People go to shul. Shkoyach, so they go to shul. How does that answer the question that they're still long life should only be in Israel? Listen to his answer. He says, because a shul, right, a shul of Beit Knesset, is a chelek of Eretz Yisrael. He says, this Gemara proves that when you build a shul in Chutz La'aretz, it's mamash admat Eretz Yisrael, mamash, and he quotes there a Megillah, the Gemara Masechet Megillah, which says, Atidim Batei Knesset, says the Gemara Masechet Megillah, in the Kavtet, Atidim Batei Knesset, Batei Mitzvah Babel, in the future, the Batei Knesset, Batei Midrash, in Babel, will make Aliyah, will come to Israel. He says, what does that mean? Because he says, because they belong in Israel, they are a chelek of Eretz Israel, and therefore he says, there's arichut yamim in Chutz La'aretz, if you go into, if because the Chutz La'aretz is connected, a shul is connected to Israel. And here's the idea I want to share with you. Just like the Israeli embassy in New York, or Washington, the Israeli embassy in Pretoria in South Africa, or in Ottawa, the Israeli embassy, from a legal point of view, is considered extraterritorial Israel. It's actually legally a chelek of Eretz Israel, of Medinat Israel. So too is a shul spiritually extraterritorial land of Eretz Israel. Which means, I believe, and this is my point, the responsibility of the diaspora Jewry is how do we make sure that our Jewish communities, our shuls, our Batei Midrash, are totally infused with Eretz Yisrael, because they are Be'etzem Admat Eretz Yisrael. How can they be distant from Eretz Yisrael? And that will depend on the rabbinic leadership, it will depend on the educators, it will depend on all the things that the esteemed Rabbanim and speakers have spoken about before, to connect to Eretz Yisrael in the deepest possible way. And I want to end in saying, and all the suggestions here are amazing ones, I want to say that I think what's begun here, Rabbi, is something very special. Sarah and I were talking about it afterwards, that the RZA has facilitated 75 people coming back a second year for a two break. Please God, next year it should be 200 people. It should be that everybody, what can we do? What can the RZA, what can you do? The more connected you are to Israel, and the more time you're spending Israel, the more part of your Hawaii, of who you are, is connected to Israel. Not only a gap year, because we all know, Rabbi and I spoke about this, when people go back to the colleges, and let's say they don't make Aliyah after their college experience. There's a whole age group in the 20s and 30s that people are lost, and there aren't enough frameworks to connect them deeply to Torah and Eretz Yisrael, to Torah and Eretz Yisrael. And I think this is a fantastic start of finding ways for you and us to proactively connect you and reconnect you to Eretz Yisrael, to Torah, to Eretz Yisrael in the most profound ways, that each one of you in your communities, in your college campuses, will see yourselves as part of Admat Eretz Yisrael. Wherever you are, the Jewish community that you are needs to be deeply connected. If it's fighting BDS, for those who are capable, we heard Darshan Leitner, the amazing work that she's doing. It's as ambassadors, educators, mechanchim, activists. There are so many things to do. And may each one of us go back to our Kila with the Avir of Eretz Yisrael, the Shmek that we had of Eretz Yisrael, and see ourselves as connecting our communities through the Ruach of Eretz Yisrael to Israel, because ultimately a Beit Knesset and Beit Midrash is supposed to be Admat Eretz Yisrael, deeply connected in every possible way.
I will ask one question to the panelists, and then we'll open up questions to the audience. Something that was common with everything that was said on this panel, which was all excellent, was the issue of unity. Yishai, you spoke of how you can come to Israel, but also Israel can come to you. And you spoke about how sometimes there's unity created when others from Israel provide something to America. And Mr. Plato, you spoke about the unity that happens when someone comes from Chutz La'aretz to Israel and is truly affected by the place. You spoke also about how your son at his tekes had this sort of kibbutz galiut of sorts when he was in conversation with people from all different parts of the world conversing in Hebrew and a common language. And Rabbi Blau, you spoke about how in the yeshivot, in midrashot, many Americans do not make the effort of speaking in Hebrew and interacting with Israelis, in part because it's easier, but you stressed how this is urgent, an urgent need to have conversation going back and forth between the Israelis and the Americans from Chutz La'aretz. And finally, Rav Perez, you were noting how there are things that diaspora can offer Israel, and now specifically what Israel can offer to the diaspora. So the question that I ask you is the following. Since there can be and should be unity between Israeli Jewry and diaspora Jewry, which means can make that happen? In what way can we start creating a common language for each other? I'm saying there has to be some method, some way we can bridge this gap so that we can truly feel united instead of feeling like we're in totally different camps. Is there some way that we can feel like we're amachad v'levachad, and that it's not just some verbiage, but it's a true feeling that we have? What can be done to make this bridge happen? And furthermore, where should this happen? Is this feeling going to be possible in Chutz La'aretz? Is this feeling only possible to be had when you're actually in Israel? How is this conversation going to happen? Where is this conversation going to happen? And who should be the ones to start it?
Since I'm the only one without smicha sitting on the panel.
Sarah,
I don't have smicha, thank you.
Let's not open up that issue.
I walked right into that one, didn't I? I think the answer to the excellent question. I think the answer is for Israeli and American Jews to keep talking to each other, talk about the things that we have in common, and talk about the things that we'd like to have in common, but most importantly, keep the conversation going. The comment was made earlier about the lack of Ivrit B'Ivrit education in America. I think the tide is turning, slowly but steadily. So we have a common language. But we do have a common religion. We have a common faith. Whether you are consider yourself a Reformed Jew in America, or an unsure Jew in America, or an Orthodox or Haredi Jew in America, you identify yourself as a Jew. So the idea, to my way of thinking, is to keep Orthodox and Reform and Conservative and Reconstructionist and the Haredi Jews talking to each other and not shutting the doors in each other's face. And that may be, to my way of thinking, the most vital thing that's unfortunately missing in America, because we don't want to hear what the other fellow is saying. But the fact of the matter is, while we can't necessarily agree on the religious fundamentals of what we believe in, we can certainly talk about the social fundamentals that we all believe in. We can work, the Orthodox can work with Reform and Conservative Jews on social issues, and by and large, we'll have a better respect for each other at the end of the day. So I get back to the main theme is conversation and to keep on talking, and that's the only way to strengthen the entire people of Israel.
All right, in order to kind of shake it up and create some controversy on this panel, I'm going to do what I do best, which is disagree. And with respect, of course. The first thing is, Rabbi Blau, your comment about India not being the most Jewish place. We can't shut down the India track for Israelis. It's very important. It's where a lot of them actually meet Judaism for the first time. And there are all kinds of shlichim, including Chabad and others, that are sitting in all these places. And an Israeli kid who's never put on tefillin comes to you after a three-day trek. He's off his rocker, you know, high, and whatever it is. And he's like, yeah, man, I'll try tefillin. And it just works out. A lot of people come back more religious. We desperately need that track. It won't happen in Tel Aviv. It happens in India. That's disagreement number one. Disagreement number two is that the question on this panel is, on this round is, how do we keep that unity and where does it happen? So, both my colleagues to my right and my left mentioned, without using the word specifically, something Rabbi Blau said about justification, about why you're in Chutz La'aretz, and so did Stephen mention this, you know, why I'm not there. Here's where it's not going to happen for you. It's not going to happen through guilt. If you're going to feel guilty about whatever choices, it's just, Israel's not going to be exciting and attractive if you're like, I'm lo beseder, I'm somehow not okay if I didn't totally do something all the way. What I mean by that is, Stephen, if you're in America right now, if they ask you, why are you not in Israel? Tom, because I'm here to bug you, okay? I'm here to bother you all day, every day, in order to get you to connect to Israel. You know the famous joke? Do you know the famous joke? There's a famous joke that goes like this. This guy got, like, Eretz Yisrael eyes. He got into, like, a zone shul. In the Beit Knesset, he was constantly talking about Eretz Yisrael, Eretz Yisrael. He's like, look at the Parsha, there's Eretz Yisrael, it says, land of milk and honey, land of our forefathers, we all have to go, we all have to go. So they said back to him, why don't you go already, go. So he, after a year of bothering them, he left. And then after a year, he came back. So they said to him, no, why'd you come back? He said, I couldn't live without the yearning for Eretz Yisrael, you know. So a Jew's got to be passionate about something, and a Jew always has to have something lacking in order to get excited. You know, just don't give him the standard answer. Oh, I feel guilty. Rabbi Blau, your institution, Yeshiva University, could be an amazing bridge towards Israel. And you yourself, as the head mashgiach, have had a tremendous influence. And many of my best friends here in Israel, most, came from my classes at Yeshiva University. So it's a bridgehead. It's a port of embarkation to the land of Israel, and it's very important. And it could be bigger. It should be bigger, and that's my criticism always has been, that it could be bigger. My young friends, it's not going to happen through guilt. It's going to happen through something that your colleagues on the other side of the political aisle have a lot of, and you don't have enough of. Do you know what that is? They are burning up with passion to create a Palestinian state, to boycott this diseased big Goliath called Israel. Your J Street colleagues, Jewish ones, have something that we lack on the side of the right and the good and the truth, which is heated passion. In Chabad, they say, why is it that God wanted to had Aaron turn the Nile from water to blood? Because that was a teaching for the Jewish people how you have to serve God. Don't serve him with cold water. Serve him in blood, in hot blood. That's something we have to do. And I remember I was one of the ways that I got engaged to my wife, who was with me together at Cardozo Law School, and she was from a small town in Texas, and she was a pork eating Jew. Actually, 2 years before we met, she took a vow to become a vegetarian. I think because her neshama couldn't eat pork anymore at her house, but she was. But still strongly pro-Israel. Anyway, Bill Clinton was coming to our university, to the Cardozo Law, to receive a prize from the International Law Society, and we protested him. And there was a guy, he was a son of, there were twins, and they were sons of a rabbi at Ben Chaim, I think?
Yeah.
Rabbi Ben Chaim. There was these twins. They were at Cardozo Law School with me, or one of them was anyway. And when Bill was walking past us, everybody, we were like, blah, 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 right? We were doing the protest thing. We were protesting the whole Oslo, given a, you know, we didn't think that Bill, it doesn't matter if you agree or not, we didn't think that Bill Clinton did a great job by bringing Yasser Arafat to the White House. We were protesting, we were law students. So we were doing the classic protest, blah, 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 blah. And everybody's like, the media was like, whatever. And he was walking past us. And this guy, Ben Chaim, was a rabbi's son, went to the front of the line. And he goes, he yelled right in his face. I have to move the mic. He goes, anti-Semite! And everybody's like, shh. And the cameras were like this. And Clinton was like this. And everybody was like, and I learned a big lesson. You cannot run a protest with like, here's our good message. And it don't work. It only works when you're like heated crazy about something. And the other side, they're totally heated crazy about their narrative that they've drawn about Israel. And we've got a problem that we are just not supercharged. And it's just not going to come through guilt. It's not going to come through guilt. It's going to come through, I'm living in Teaneck because that's where I chose to live for, because my parents are here, because my parents are here. Fine. But I am I'm a white and a blue and white, or a black and white Zionist. Or Eretz Yisraelic, whatever it is. By the way, I don't care what language you use. It doesn't have to be the blue and white flag Medina variants of Zionism. It could be a black and white, Kodesh Baruch Hu gave us mitzvahs of Luyos Baritz. I don't care. It doesn't matter. Use whatever lingo turns you on, but you have to do it with passion. And that's what I want to recommend to you. I'll give you just one example, and then I'll pass the mic over. Many times I'll give a talk to students your age, maybe a little bit younger, to like, let's say boys. This happens often with boys. 50 boys in a classroom, and then one or two guys will come up afterwards and say to me, Yishai, what do you think about the army? Do you think I should go to the army? Two guys out of 50. And I always say to them, if you came up to me, this thought has been in your mind, and you came up to me to ask me, not the other guys, they all didn't have it in them. Don't mess it up in your life. Don't miss the opportunity to go to the army because you want it, because you're that kind of guy. You've got it in you. And I know people like you who are 60, 65, who missed the boat, and they're like, oh, I should have gone to the army. If you have it in you, do it. Be passionate about it. If you want to live in Teaneck, fine. But make sure that you do something that turns it on. Don't be lame about things, guys. Don't be like, milquetoast, oh, good trips. Forget it. That is just not where it's at. And your colleagues on the other side are super fired up. That's what I'm asking you for. It's not just about the ideas and Torah, Eretz Yisrael. That's all dandy. If you're not like partially pissed off, you have to have an element. And if you don't have one, find one. Okay? I'm angry personally about UNESCO. What? This United Nations organization is denying the very Maratha Machpelah is Jewish. United States of America does not recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, does not recognize Jerusalem as a city in Israel. I'd be ticked off if I was you. Fine. You know, ticked off. Or be passionate about environmentalism. You want to see solar panels all over the south of Israel. Fine. You want to be in medical breakthroughs. Great. I met a guy, he says to me, Yisha, you met me off an airplane on Nefesh B'Nefesh Aliyah. I'm like, great, how are you doing? He says, yeah, I'm doing good. I opened up an organic pet food store in Ra'anana. I'm like, loser, okay? Oh God, he's going to ask me for money or something. I don't know, because I'm doing great gangbusters. What? It's like, line out the door. People want organic pet food. Of course, I knew that. Everybody wants organic pet food. The point is that he had a vision. He was passionate about organic pet food. He made it happen. You have to have passion. And if you're going to be a cold Jew, forget it. It doesn't work. You got to be turned on. And that's where it's going to happen. The bridge is going to happen through passion.
You try to open the opportunity. I disagree with him completely. I think just passion is where we get into a lot of terrible trouble. I think passion has to be balanced with the reason. But
it's a low point. I love,
come on, Yishai, you can get away. I think unity, the word unity often demands too much. I don't think we can expect, Ki'ishu ha'belev achad was one moment in Jewish history. We certainly have demonstrated since then that we're really an Am She'orach, we're very argumentative people. And not just stubborn, but argumentative. What I'm looking for is a basic commonality, a recognition of interdependence on each other. Disagreement is fine. That's what Jews are all about. Could you imagine learning Gemara with no machlokas? It'd make it a lot easier. Or learning Tanakh. You have to listen to the shiur that Rachel Frankel gave, and just listen to the relationship that the Navi had with Malkei Yehuda, right? And the conflicts that were going on during the time of Tanakh, right? Yes, there are going to be conflicts. There are differences. The question is, what is the commonality within the conflicts? How do we create a dialogue? Dialogue of people means people disagree. They're having a dialogue. I mean, yesterday I was invited to the yeshiva where my son is one of the Rashi yeshiva, and I had a dialogue with him. I thought it was ridiculous. And we're having a dialogue because we speak in sometimes different terms, but I don't think there was one issue we managed to seriously disagree about. Rabbi Price tells me it seemed to work anyway, but I'm glad. Anyway, dialogue is when you dialogue with people you disagree with, but you care enough to try to convince them and to realize that we have something in common. And when I think in this case, I used to think America and Jews have what to offer to Israel, because Israeli dialogue in the political arena is not a dialogue. It's people screaming at each other and walking out of the room. Everything is absolute, and they're right, and everybody else is wrong. Unfortunately, American political dialogue is moving in this exact same direction. In some ways, worse, you know. And, you know, insulting the opponent is not dialogue. But we have to reach out to others who are different from ourselves. We have to even start, before we talk about American-Israeli Jewry, within our own communities. You know, my impression is that most people now in the modern Orthodox world have not had a serious conversation with a Haredi Jew, with a Reform Jew. You know, one of the qualities, I'm not really picking on Tinak, I like him, is that there's so many opportunities to discuss differences within the same thing. Right? Every shul is a little bit different. Like, you know, I daven in this shul, not in that shul, because when the difference from the outside is, you know, negligible. I always tell the kids when they're in 12th grade and they're having to decide where to study in Israel. And, you know, and they want to make the right choice, right? And they can know exactly the difference between each one of the yeshivot. Right? I said, you're right, all right. Now go to someone outside your community and explain to them the difference between where they go to, I'm not going to mention names, they're out of trouble, to go to yeshivot that are always in disagreement, and both heads of yeshivot, and tell someone outside the world of the modern Orthodox community, and they'll look at you and say, they're the same thing. What are you talking about? Because when you don't reach outside of your own community, so you get your dialogue about little things. When you reach out of your community, you'll get your dialogue about more important things. We have to reach out. You know, thank God, Orthodox Judaism has proven that it's here to stay. 60 years ago in America, people weren't sure about that. You know, Ben-Gurion let the yeshiva students not go in the army because he figured how many are there and there won't be any. Right? Now that we're here to stay, doesn't mean we don't have problems. Everybody has problems. Everybody has issues. We're here to stay. We can feel strong enough to talk to people different from ourselves. And when I talk about differences between American and Israeli young people, the answer is only going to be if you talk to each other. I can't make it happen, you know. You have to care enough and allow for people to disagree with you and to have a different perspective, and say, but we are brothers anyway, or sisters, and, you know. And unity as a slogan is great, but it's a slogan. But realizing commonality, Riskin referred to the, you know, Koldo Digo fake, for those of you who should have caught the reference, when he talked about Brit Goral and Brit Yud. It means there's a commonality amongst the Jews, the commonality with all the Jews who identify with the Brit Goral, whether they're religious or not, and within the religious community, we have a common destiny, even if we define our religious ways in things that are very different. Reach out, be the ones to take the initiative, you know, talk to people different with you. When you get in positions of greater leadership, organize these debates. World won't come to an end if you debate with other people, right? When I'm coming back to America, I'm going to a debate taking place in a synagogue that dropped out of the conservative movement because it was too out there for the conservative movement, with a left-wing Zionist, with a Labor Zionist, and I wasn't sure, but maybe with a Palestinian, to present what religious Zionism is. I'm not afraid of debating with other people. Of course, I'm cheating because I'm not letting them into my shul, and I'm going to theirs, but that's their choice, not mine. Talk to other people. In that sense, I agree with Isha about passion. Talk with them with passion. I think back with some rationality. That your arguments are not just passion. I don't see calling somebody anti-Semite a very good argument. You know,
it wasn't an argument, but it made the papers.
Yeah, okay.
You take it.
I'm going to just say one brief comment the other time and give the microphone back to Sarah to wrap up. I'll just say one comment on Brit Goral, that we all have one common fate. Who's the Rasha in the Pesach Seder? The Pesach Seder is all about Brit Goral, it's about Yitzhak Mitzrayim. Who's the Rasha? The one who doesn't keep Shabbos, the one who doesn't believe in Hashem, the one who mistreats his fellow Jew. Who's the Rasha? Amazingly, the Rasha of Pesach, which is about Brit Goral, it is Brit Goral about one people, about one fate, is the one shotzit atzmo min haklal. The moment you don't see your lot thrown in with a lot of the Jewish people, you're outside of Brit Goral. That's the danger of all these BDSs to the left and Narag Vot to the right, where you find people who are sort of outside of Jewish society, don't believe in Jewish destiny in the way that we believe in it, seen in a very sectarian way, or on the left-hand side, or maybe the narrow word wasn't the right comparison. That's something else. I'd say Notoria Karta on the right and BDS, those who work for BDS on the left. The moment you see that you can march with with enemies of the Jewish people and not march with your own people, the moment you might see yourself from the club, that you don't find any commonality with your fellow Jews, no matter how different their opinions are, then I think there's no more conversation left. We have to be within the cloud, the Goral, so also beautifully by those before me. We don't have time, and I want to hand back to Sarah. Thank you.
Can we have a round of applause for our panelists? Thank you for giving us so much to think about. This was quite thought-provoking, and because we're running very late, if you have any other questions, please save it for after Mincha, because what we're going to do is we're going to have men in the front, women in the back. We're going to set up a mechitza of some sorts. We're going to daven mincha. Afterwards, if you'd like to speak to them, can you stick around for a few minutes? Oh, fabulous. And after that, we'll go on to our next speaker, which I believe is of Paris. So everyone, please get ready for mincha. Thank you.
Hey, ladies and gents, just to quickly tell you the rest of the program very briefly, I'll ask you please to stay for it. We've got a very special speaker.